Hello, you misfit murderinos, you. This is Kate.
The murderinos, and this is Kevin.
Welcome to Horrorwood. Bum, bum, bum. Oh, I liked that little musical intro you just gave.
Thank you. I'm having a nice holiday weekend.
Nice.
Because it's Easter.
It is.
Which, yes.
Although this is coming out after
Easter. Oh, it's after Easter, yeah. The eggs are spoiled. They got hidden and never found.
Oh, gross. I don't really celebrate Easter.
I don't either. There's a little movie that I watch every Easter called Here Comes Peter Cottontail.
Here comes Peter Cottontail hopping down the bunny trail.
Hippity hoppity, Easter's on its way.
Ooh. Oh my gosh. Wow, we just had a childhood memory together.
Oh. But no, I watch it every year, and it's about Peter Cottontail.
Like, you don't say.
Taking over the the Easter Bunny job.
I'm in a weird place.
That's okay.
Right now.
Me too, Kate. And he goes through all of the holidays and makes like holiday eggs for each holiday.
Kind of like The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Exactly.
With the trees.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I wish that this was like a fun episode. It's not. It's horrible. But I'm really excited to talk about this person.
Yeah.
Because I had not heard of her before this. She was on our list.
Okay.
And so here's the thing with the Google Doc, you guys, that we look for cases. Like, I throw names on there just if I come across something, I'm like, oh, that could be something. So we have 18 pages of names.
It's a long list.
That I don't necessarily like remember why I put them on that list or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was scrolling through because I was trying to find a case and I was like, I wonder who Patricia Douglas is. Like, why did I add her onto this list? She's probably a woman who you've never heard of. Her case did get some resurgence recently when the Me Too movement was in the headlines, but I didn't know who she was. And she's like such an important figure in history. So I'm going to tell you about her today.
I look forward.
I will say a content warning, lots of discussion of rape in this case. Patricia or Patsy Douglas had no aspirations to become famous. She didn't dream of becoming an actor, and Hollywood celebrities just didn't impress her. She couldn't have cared less. In fact, as a young girl growing up in Kansas City, Missouri, Hollywood was the furthest thing from her mind. But the same couldn't be said of her mom. Patsy's mom, Mildred Mitchell, wasn't dreaming of an acting career, but as a dressmaker, she was hoping to design gowns for the leading ladies of the time.
Ooh.
And the time I speak of is the early 1900s.
Oh, shit.
Patsy, born Patricia Dorothy Douglas, was born on March 27th, 1917. IMDb says March 24th. I think Wikipedia said March 5th. But
it was in March.
there's a book I'll reference that gives her birth date as the 27th, and findagrave.com also listed as the 27th. So
shout out to findagrave.com.
I'm going with the 27th. And this is crazy. So when I was writing this episode, I looked at the date at the bottom of the screen, like my little calendar, and it was March 27th. And that's happened at least like a couple of times, I think, where it's the person's birthday or an anniversary that I wasn't even aware of. And I was like, I feel like Patsy's like telling me, tell my story.
What's that term? Is it like kismet or
something, or serendipity?
Serendipity. That's the one I was looking for.
It was just interesting because it's not like her name is in the news right now and I came across it through Google, you know? I happened to look at that Google Doc and her name just popped out at me. And then I wrote her episode on her birthday, which is just wild.
That's really wild. The ghosts in the closet helped with that.
Maybe they did.
I bet they were like just giving you that energy push of like, Patty.
Patsy.
Sorry. Patsy.
Yeah, she did prefer Patsy because later in life she did not want to be called Patricia, even though that's what she went by growing up. So that's what I'm going to call her in this episode, is Patsy. There's no mention of any siblings that I could find, and it sounds like her dad was out of the picture. Mm. In fact, according to Michelle Morgan's book, The Mammoth Book of Hollywood Scandals, Mildred had 8 unsuccessful marriages. So it doesn't sound like things were very stable at home.
Yikes.
And in newspaper articles, there are 2 other names given for Patsy. So one is Patricia Schellenberger, I think, and then another one is Mary Mitchell. My guess is with all of those husbands that her mom had, her name changed
along with those. Of course, at the time, it probably wasn't an option for
women to not take
the last name.
I don't know what, you know, their story was, sure. but she went by Patsy Douglas throughout her life. So,
oh, good for her then.
That's what we're going to call her. Patsy and Mildred didn't have a very close relationship. Mildred wasn't exactly the loving, doting type of mom. And with it just being Patsy and her mom wishing to make it big in Hollywood, Mildred packed up the 2 of them and headed to California.
Hi. That's what she said when they got... She said hi.
She was like, hi. Hi, bitch.
Hi, bitch.
Patsy was still a young girl at the time and really had no choice in the matter.
Gah.
The 2 of them settled into a home at 1160 South Bronson Avenue in Los Angeles, and Mildred quickly got to work trying to make a name for herself in the design world. Unfortunately, her dream of making dresses for celebrities never came to fruition. And instead, she ended up working as, quote, a couturier, which is my best attempt at a French accent, for high-end call girls. Basically, she was a seamstress for female escorts.
I mean, hey, that's still a...
It's still a job.
Job.
When Mildred was working and marrying all these men, Patsy, who at this point was a young teenager, was attending convent school.
Ah!
Which sounds horrid.
Oh, my God.
And perhaps Patsy thought it was horrid because she dropped out when she was 14 years old.
Good.
Her mom had enough money to support the 2 of them, which when you think about back then... That was highly unusual for a woman and many times an unwed mother. So with her mom's money being sufficient for the 2 of them, there was no pressing need for Patsy to get a job. It wasn't like she dropped out of school because she had to start working. She just didn't want to be in convent school.
I don't think anybody does.
Mm-mm. But Patsy was kind of on her own at home. Her mom didn't really pay much attention to her, and Patsy got bored. She needed something to do. She'd always been a really talented dancer. In an interview with David Stinn later in her life, she said, quote, I was good. I moved just like J-Lo.
There's like a video of J-Lo like in her documentary where her hair's all messed up. And she's like, it reminds me of when I was a little girl, a little crazy girl in the Bronx running up and down the block. And someone like took that audio and then put it on like this wire haired dog that's like has this giant and it's like.
Amazing.
So good.
Send it to me. A lot of movies hire dancers. And now that she was living in the place where the movies are made, she thought, hey, I could probably get a job in the film industry doing something I love and that I'm good at. And Patsy was right. She was able to get into the film industry dancing. She started answering casting calls for dancers, and it wasn't long before she was dancing on stage with Ginger Rogers and being choreographed by Busby Berkeley himself. Busby Berkeley was a famed choreographer of movie musicals back in the day.
I didn't know that. Bugsby.
Busby.
Busby's. Fuck.
I like that you're just kind of hearing what you want their names to be.
Hey, listen.
You know what? I will say, to Kevin's credit, it is probably the earliest he's ever had to get up and come over to my place.
You know, we'll get there. Busby.
Busby.
Jesus Christ. Busby.
It's safe to say that a lot of the girls who danced alongside Patsy were looking to make it big in the movies. There was a lot of trying to get on camera more and trying to talk to the lead actors, but that wasn't Patsy. She didn't care about any of that, which is exactly why celebrities were drawn to her. She was just about the best kid any parent could ask for. She didn't drink. She didn't date. She was your quintessential good girl.
Wow.
Had Mildred paid any attention to her, she would have realized what a dream daughter she had.
She was too busy sewing up those undie pants for the
ladies,
for the sex workers.
So the male stars she met on set liked her, not in a creepy sexual way, but in a very refreshing, hey, here's a talented young woman who isn't trying to flirt with me and isn't trying to use me to further her career kind of way. So as a teenager, she was going to the drive-in with actor Dick Powell. She was hanging out on Sunset Boulevard with Bing Crosby and William Frawley, who would go on to star later in I Love Lucy. Actor George Raft saw her as sort of a kid's sister that he could confide in. Again, she didn't seek these relationships out. They just happened organically because celebrities knew she was trustworthy. She wasn't going to run to the press the next day and say, "You'll never believe what Bing Crosby told me." And she didn't want anything from them. I think for her, it was a way to be out of the house, and it was just something to do. And Patsy was doing pretty well for herself as a dancer. On Sunday, May 2nd, 1937, a call came in from casting director Vincent Conniff looking for dancers for MGM's Wild Wild West show. It was advertised as a film and needed about 120 females. So Patsy just thought, all right, I'd be good for this, sure. On Wednesday, May 5th, she, along with the 100-plus other girls, reported for work at the Hal Roach Studios in Culver City, about a block from MGM. Hal Roach was a producer. He's probably best known for the R-Gang series, as well as the Laurel and Hardy shorts. And all those were distributed by MGM. And he was producing the Wild Wild West show.
Wild Wild West. Do you remember the
Will Smith?
Yeah, I do. When you said that, that popped into my head, and I was like...
Isn't it like, everybody, welcome to the Wild Wild West?
That was a big song. I wish I could remember
more of
that.
I'm pretty sure I had it on CD.
Yeah, me too.
And then he went and slapped Chris Rock at the Oscars.
Fucker. Macbeth was in that. Remember?
No.
They had just, when I did the Macbeth curse, like.
Oh.
Chris Rock had just said Macbeth because Denzel Washington was in it.
Oh, okay, okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Ooh. I also remember Burger King did a bunch of like Wild Wild West promos.
Oh, I do remember that. Oh, wow. We're really bringing back the childhood memories right
now. I love it.
I like you're wearing your Saved by the Bell
hoodie.
That's
what's bringing it back.
I think so.
I also remember when Burger King did Teletubbies and they had tubby custard.
I don't remember that.
It was delicious. It was literally vanilla pudding.
Sounds gross.
But it was great.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
Anywho.
The dancers were going to go through wardrobe, hair and makeup at the Hal Roach Studios and then be shuttled to the location. Mm-hmm. The dancers were all between the ages of 15 and 25 years old.
Youngins.
At the time, Patsy was 20 years old, but she was still considered a minor because at that time, the age of majority in California was 21.
Oh, shit. I think we should bring that back.
The costumes they were given were described as cowgirl outfits. They wore cowboy hats, bolero jackets, short suede skirts, and black boots. And they were all done up with heavy makeup for camera. Mm-hmm. After going through makeup and wardrobe, the girls were shuttled to the location set, which was at Rancho Rochero, another Hal Roach property. It was several miles away in a remote area.
Ew, I don't love that.
No, you shouldn't. And that's not uncommon. Even today on a lot of sets that are on location, there will be a base camp where everyone gets ready. And then depending on where that set is, you might be able to walk to it. Or if it's too far, you get shuttled to
it. Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense. Like a hub for everything to kind of come in and out of.
Because if you're shooting a Western and you need those big shots of like an open field and there's horses or whatever.
It's going to be pretty remote.
Yeah, you've got to be able to have everyone getting ready somewhere far away from that.
How interesting. Thank you for the lesson in location shooting, Kate.
Well, you're welcome, Kevin. So for any of the dancers who walked or took public transportation to work that day, they are now several miles away from that base camp. There's no public transportation going to this remote ranch, and if they drove, their cars were left back at that first studio. All this to say, once the girls were on the bus to the location, there was really no escape.
Love that. There's no escape. Oh my God.
When
I have to blow my nose.
Sure, go for it. Blow it out. Well.
Okay.
I might or might not keep that in. And if I don't happen to keep it in, just know that Kevin blew his nose directly into the microphone.
Oh, I mean,
and it was
over here.
Oh, you were over there? It was really loud.
I know. Oh my God. It's just, I didn't even think of that, Kate.
It was so loud.
Oh no.
But it's okay. I mean, that was me every day last week. I had the worst cold ever.
I'm so glad you're feeling better.
I was just walking around with tissues shoved up my nostrils all day, every day.
I hate that feeling. It was the worst. The only, like, it's just, it kind of just keeps.
Oh, the worst. And then I had to sleep with them like that because my nose kept running in the night. And I'm so sorry. The worst. Any hoops. So when the dancers arrived at the ranch, they were all corralled into this large banquet hall and told to sit at a table and wait. Again, nothing seems out of the ordinary because there's always an extras holding on set, and the dancers were considered extras. So they're just hanging out waiting for their next instructions. And while they were waiting, an orchestra was being set up and a bar was being set up, but there was no camera crew and there was no lighting equipment.
What?
And then at 7 p.m. that evening, after the dancers had been sitting there for a couple of hours, because they arrived at the studios, the first studio at 4 p.m., yeah, got ready, shuttled over to the ranch, and they just sat there for 2 hours without hearing any instructions and, like, not really knowing what's going on. They weren't told what scene they were going to be doing or even what the choreography was. Suddenly, hundreds of people descended onto the ranch. Performers like Laurel and Hardy and the Dandridge sisters, like Dorothy Dandridge and her sisters. MGM's male stars like Wallace Beery, who was super famous at the time, along with MGM execs Louis B. Mayer, Eddie Mannix, and Hal Roach. Louis B. Mayer was the studio head, Eddie Mannix was the general manager, and Hal Roach was a producer. As well as 282 salesmen from across the country.
What the fuck is this?
Not a film shoot, I can tell
you that. Not at all.
It was a party thrown by MGM to celebrate its record-breaking profits that year. And the 120 young female dancers had unknowingly all been offered up as party favors.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Nope.
What the fuck?
Yeah, this is crazy. MGM was in its golden era in the 1930s. Louis B. Mayer, as I said, was the head of the studio, and its roster included Clark Gable, Jean Harlow, Joan Crawford, Lionel Barrymore. It was the height of the Great Depression, and all the other studios were drowning, with many of them filing for bankruptcy, mm-hmm, but not MGM. In 1937, it had doubled its profits from what they were the previous year, all thanks to a little restructuring in how it handled film rentals. Up until that point, movie theaters were charged on a sliding scale based on what the box office brought in, and that amount dwindles week by week. So instead, their new plan would have the studio release the film in 30 major cities, like mm-hmm, Chicago, New York, LA. And if it was a big success in those markets, they could charge theaters a higher fee once the film went into wide release.
Oh.
It was the MGM sales executives. They're the middleman between the studio and the movie theaters. Uh-huh. The salesmen were the ones that came up with this plan, which turned out to be a very lucrative one for MGM and its head honcho, Louis B. Mayer.
Ah.
Louis B. Mayer was the highest paid person in the nation in 1937. His salary that year was $1,296,503.
How much is that today?
About $28
million. Whoa. A year?
At the height of the Great Depression.
Oh.
While the rest of the country was struggling to have enough food to eat, Mayer was Scrooge McDucking it over there, just diving into his piles of money.
Yuck.
Naturally, he wanted to thank the salesman that had made MGM and himself flush with cash.
Ooh.
That was Parks and Rec. You've seen it, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. Of course. I know what you were referencing.
Oh, okay, good. So he organized a 5-day party extravaganza.
5-day.
Mm-hmm. Technically, it was a sales convention that was held every year, but 1937 would be the first year Mayer had the convention at the studio.
Mm.
He arranged for a private rail car to transport the 282 salesmen from across the country to Los Angeles, where they arrived on May 2nd at the Pasadena train station. The station was decked out in MGM banners, and Louis B. Mayer himself was there to greet his guests. And surrounding the salesmen were several girls who had answered a classified ad looking for MGM party hostesses. They were instructed to greet the salesmen as they got off the train and to pin a carnation on each man's lapel. I'm going to play a little clip of Mayer greeting the men at the station. This is from archival footage of that event that was locked away in MGM's vault forever. David Stinn, who we're going to talk about more later, did a lot of research on this case, and mm-hmm. so he was able to find this. So let me just play that for you.
These lovely girls, and you had the finest of them, greet you, and that's to show you how we feel about you and the kind of a good time that's ahead of you starting tonight.
Oh my
so
God.
It cuts off, but what he says there, I'll say the whole thing in case it was hard to understand. He says, "These lovely girls, and you have the finest of them, greet you, and that's to show you how we feel about you and the kind of a good time that's ahead of you, starting tonight," and that's where it cuts off. But what he says is, "Starting tonight, you can have anything you want." And he repeats this throughout the convention. You can have anything. Anything you want. In the footage at the station, a girl pins a carnation on a man's lapel and he grabs her and kisses her on the mouth. And the men around are all laughing. Other girls were getting groped during this welcome ceremony as well. This sets the tone for this convention. On that first night, the salesmen were treated to a fancy dinner at the Ambassador Hotel, which is where they were all staying. The next day, they were given a police escort to MGM Studios, where they were shown around the premises while 4,000 MGM employees tossed confetti and a marching band played Hail, Hail, the Gang's All Here. They then had lunch with the studio's biggest celebrities, Clark Gable, Jean Harlow, Norma Shearer, Joan Crawford, Sophie Tucker. These salesmen are eating it up. These are guys who sit in an office all day talking numbers, and now they're sitting across from Clark Gable at the largest and most powerful film studio in the world.
Oh my God. Recipe for disaster.
It is. Like. And of course, with all these meals, they were provided alcohol as much as they wanted.
Blah.
These guys are fucking loving it. They were catered to like royalty while
sounds
their
like
wives and kids are back home unaware of any shenanigans that these guys were getting up to.
Mm-hmm.
After days of being wined and dined, salesmen checking their convention schedules for Wednesday, May 5th, would see the words, "Yippee, get set for Wild West show at Roach's. It will be a stag affair out in the wild and woolly West where men are men."
No.
And
where
as
men
usual.
Are men. Shut the fuck up.
Gross. And as usual, Louis B. Mayer emphasized that the men could have anything they wanted.
A lobster roll and a glass of champagne and Golden Girls is what I want.
Like Dorothy and Blanche and those Golden Girls?
Yes.
Okay.
What did you think of it?
Well, because we're talking about like these
oh,
girls.
Oh, no.
And I was like, wait.
No, I mean, I'm just saying like if he's like, you can have whatever you want, I would be like, excuse me, can I leave? And go to a hotel room by myself.
Don't follow me.
Do not follow me and give me those three things.
Nice. Of those three things, they do get one of them. They get a lot of champagne. And so this was the mindset of the 282 salesmen as they descended on Ranch Rochero at 7 p.m. that evening, where 120 unsuspecting underage girls waited patiently in a banquet hall where they'd been tricked into thinking that they were extras in a movie.
In a movie. Oh, this is really upsetting.
Several celebrities are there, of course. Wallace Beery, who was a big star at the time. The Dandridge sisters, who I mentioned, including 13-year-old Dorothy Dandridge. They performed a musical review. Barbecue was being served in a huge outdoor tent. Fake boxing matches were going on in the arena next to the banquet hall. And what? I say fake because they weren't real competitions. They were just for show for this party.
Okay.
They were like, let's take a fake sport and make it faker. And of course, it was open bar. 500 cases of scotch and champagne were set up for this party. Those were the only two liquors they had. You think there'd be more variety? 500 cases. That is almost two cases per guest. And one of those guests was Chicago salesman David Ross, not the former Cub player. In David Stinn's Vanity Fair article, which I'll link, he describes Ross as a, quote, roly-poly 36-year-old Catholic bachelor. Patsy described him as repulsive and slimy, with eyes that bulged like a frog. And unfortunately, once he laid his frog eyes on Patsy, he wouldn't leave her alone.
I'm sorry, it's not funny, but the way you were like, when he laid his frog eyes on Patsy.
If you look up a picture of him, there is an amphibian-like quality about his look. He's very swampy.
Isn't bulging eyes like a thyroid thing?
No idea. But if everyone could see Kevin right now, he's giving a great demonstration of bulging eyes.
I'm going to drink all the champagne.
Yikes.
Ow.
And now he's in pain.
Let me take a sip of coffee, everybody. Let's all collectively.
I'm going to take some water.
Did you already drink your coffee today, Kate?
I did. I was going to ask if you want me to put another pot on because it was so early.
I got my carafe.
Good. I'm glad for it. You ready?
Give me one sec. Just going to shake out these back things.
Because from here on out, it just gets horrible.
Well, yeah, I figured this wasn't going anywhere good.
No.
Frog eyes and whiskey and all that stuff. Okay.
The girls had been instructed to perform some country western dancing. That's where the dancing part came in. And when Ross saw Patsy dancing, he insisted she teach him how. She reluctantly agreed, but during their dance, he kept trying to grope her. She had never been in this kind of situation before, and she didn't know what to do. So as soon as the dance ended, she ran to the ladies' room, and there was a bathroom attendant in there. And she told her, I've got a man, and he's really sticking. But the bathroom attendant offered no help, no advice, and just kind of shrugged. As the night wore on, the men became more and more intoxicated. They were groping the girls, running their hands all over them, trying to force liquor down their throats. Girls kept getting up and moving from the tables to try and get away from these guys. Ginger Wyatt, an 18-year-old dancer, ran up to actor Wallace Beery and begged him to help. She said, quote, I'm tired of being mauled. He escorted her out of the banquet hall so she could get away from this party. And on the way out, he ended up punching a couple of guys who were trying to get rough with her. And he was disgusted by what he was seeing.
Thank God someone is, you know.
Patsy, though she did her best to avoid him, could not stay hidden from David Ross, and he was pissed that she had seemingly rejected him. At 86 years old, Patsy recounts that night to writer David Stinn, saying, quote, he and another man held me down. One pinched my nose so I'd have to open my mouth to breathe. Then they poured a whole glassful of scotch and champagne down my throat. Oh, I fought, but they thought it was funny. I remember a lot of laughter.
Oh, this is awful.
Patsy had never had alcohol prior to that evening. As soon as the men released her, she ran to the bathroom and vomited.
Yeah.
When she came out of the bathroom, she was feeling lightheaded, so she was like, I'll step outside. I need some fresh air. But Ross was keeping an eye on her. Just moments after she exited the banquet hall, Ross snuck up behind her, put his hand over her mouth, and said, make a sound and you'll never breathe again. He then dragged her to one of the studio cars parked in the field, pushed her onto the back seat, and said, I'm going to destroy you. Then he began violently raping her.
Oh my God.
She started to black out during the attack, at which point he slapped her across the face and shouted, cooperate. I want you awake.
No.
Patsy began screaming, which alerted Clement Soth, a parking attendant who was nearby. As she screamed, Ross ran away, but not before Clement got a good look at him.
Good.
Patsy stumbled through the field. She could barely walk. Her eyes were swollen shut, and she was in a lot of pain. Tom Lindsay, one of the 11 police officers who'd been hired to keep an eye on things at the party, accompanied Patsy to the Culver City Community Hospital, right across the street from MGM Studios. And yet, he didn't bother to file a crime scene report. Once Patsy got to the hospital, she vomited again. She was told to undress so she could be examined, and she was humiliated, not only for the torture she'd just been through, but because she had never undressed in front of anyone.
Oh, this is hard.
She didn't date, and she was a virgin when David Ross raped her. A male doctor, Dr. Edward Lindquist, who also co-owned the hospital, performed the exam on Patsy. but not before giving her a cold water douche, which of course destroyed all physical evidence.
What the fuck?
Afterwards, he said he didn't think any intercourse had taken place. He's like, I don't see anything. Dr. Lindquist just so happened to be the doctor for MGM's employees.
I was just going to say, what does he get out of, like...
His business relied heavily. On the movie studio.
What a fucking asshole.
Oh, just wait, because everyone sucks in this story. Except for Patsy. After the shoddy exam, Patsy was driven home in an MGM studio car by an MGM employee. And once home, she fell asleep for 14 hours.
Good.
Her body was just depleted.
Yeah.
When she woke up, she still felt a lot of pain in her vagina and her face was still swollen. But she chose not to go see a doctor because she just couldn't bear to undress in front of another person. After a couple of days resting at home, Patsy went back to the Hal Roach Studios because she wanted to tell someone what had happened to her so that it wouldn't happen to anyone else. She was greeted by Maud Van Curen, the cashier, who, after hearing Patsy's story, said nothing, just handed her her $7.50 pay for a day's work as though it was all just part of the job. MGM never followed up with Patsy to see how she was doing, and she couldn't stand the thought that this lizard David Ross could get away with such a horrific crime. So Patsy did something that was unheard of at the time. She convinced her mother to take her to the L.A. County District Attorney's office so she could file a complaint against David Ross.
Good.
Because she was a minor, she had to have her mother there to co-sign the documents.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
It's not as though Mildred was like, oh my God, are you okay? Let me help you get justice. There was none of that. Mildred was mortified that her daughter was speaking up about this. She wanted her to keep quiet. But Patsy refused. No woman before her had ever gone up against a Hollywood film studio, much less MGM, the largest studio in the world, and claimed she had been sexually assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
Women didn't do it because they knew their lives and careers would be ruined. That still happens today.
Oh, of course.
Patsy knew what she was up against, but said, quote, I didn't care. I just wanted to be vindicated, to hear someone say, you can't do that to a woman. The L.A. district attorney at the time was Buron Fitz. He was serving his third term in office despite having been indicted for perjury in a rape case involving a 16-year-old girl. Seems like a real stand-up guy. And guess which major studio had been Fitz's top campaign contributor?
MGM.
Dun-dun-dun. Furthermore, Buron Fitz and Louis B. Mayer... We're like best buds. So for reasons which I think are abundantly clear, Fitz didn't get back to Patsy regarding her complaint. After weeks of waiting with no word from the district attorney's office, she found another attorney, William J.F. Brown. And Brown agreed to take on Patsy's case and represent her pro bono. Brown told Fitz, either investigate my client's complaint or she's going to the press. And Fitz was like, she's not going to go to the press. And Patsy went to the press.
Good. Fuck yes.
But what she probably wasn't aware of is that much of the press was owned by William Randolph Hearst. He owned the Los Angeles Examiner, the Chicago Examiner, the Detroit Times, the Washington Herald, and the San Francisco Examiner, along with several others. And William Randolph Hearst financed multiple MGM films. And then, of course, those MGM films would be given reviews that appeared in Hearst's papers. And Hearst and Louis B. Mayer were tight. Hearst, being 20 years older than Mayer, referred to the studio head as son. And they were even practically neighbors, living just a few doors down from one another. So when Patsy's story went to the press, MGM's name didn't appear anywhere in the articles, nor did David Ross's name. But Patsy's did. Not only did the papers print her full name and age, but included her photo and her home address.
What the fuck?
This is a minor, remember. And back then, any woman who had been raped was considered damaged goods. It was considered her fault. So now her photo, name, address, everything is out there. MGM was simply referred to as, quote, a local film studio. MGM, without being named, released the following statement in response to the press coverage. Quote, "We have read with astonishment the alleged charges of the girl. It is difficult to make any real comment as to a situation which appears so impossible and as to which we know nothing." Lies. They knew everything. Back then, newspapers refused to print the word rape. So instead, they would use words like attacked or even worse, ravished. The Los Angeles Daily News, in their June 9th, 1937 article, refers to rapist David Ross as a girl ravisher. William Randolph Hearst wrote a letter to his dear friend, Louis B. Mayer, saying, and this is a quote, "Gee whiz, Louis, do you realize how damaging that is to the whole moving picture industry and fraternity? I'm going to do everything I can now to help the situation, of course, but the public will be sympathetic with a poor little extra girl." MGM owned everything back then. They were like the mob, seriously.
It's insane.
They controlled not just the district attorney's office, but the police department, the hospital, the newspapers, everything.
Everything. Local government, all kind of...
All of it. Not to mention, they were the largest employer in L.A. County. That's a lot of power. And if Lowe's Inc., their parent company, were to find out that they held a massive wild party with an open bar and dozens of underage girls, their stockholders were going to be pissed.
Good.
So the studio conducted a smear campaign in an effort to destroy Patsy. They enlisted, this is bananas, they enlisted the Pinkerton Detective Agency, which has been around since 1850. They are a private detective firm, and the majority of their work consists of trying to bust up unions. As recently as 2020, Amazon hired the agency to spy on their workers and report any signs that workers were trying to unionize. So this private detective agency was tasked with digging up everything they could on innocent, underage Patsy Douglas. They secretly followed her, obeying orders from the studio to find men that she surely must have propositioned for sex. She must be a heavy drinker. Find out which bar she frequents. But their search turned up nothing.
Yeah.
Only that Patsy did not drink and had been a virgin before she was raped.
Yeah.
So that didn't go according to plan.
Woof.
The agency did learn that Patsy had previously been treated for a cyst on her bladder. So Hal Roach himself contacted her doctor, Dr. Wirt Dakin, and requested that he re-diagnose the cyst as gonorrhea.
No, and he, please tell me he didn't do that.
He did not, thank goodness.
Ugh.
They wanted to be able to say, well, she has a sexually transmitted disease, so she must be promiscuous. Mm. And based on how rape was defined back then, if they could find a way to say she was, in fact, promiscuous, then legally, back then, they could claim her attack was not rape.
What the fuck, Kate?
Yeah, we are not okay as
a
human race or as a society. This is obviously decades before HIPAA went into effect.
Of course.
Dr. Dakin was like, no, do you want me to lose my license? He refused.
Good.
Can you imagine that? That is like Steven Spielberg calling your doctor today and saying, hey, that very minor innocuous thing you treated Kevin for a while back, can you just say it was syphilis? It would really help us out a lot. Thanks. That is what happened. They're like, just let's give her gonorrhea and call it good. So since Patsy's record was squeaky clean and her doctor refused to risk his entire career by lying, the studio was a little panicked.
Good. You should be.
So they had Pinkerton track down every single girl who had been hired for the party that night and bully them into making false statements about Patsy. The studio paid these girls to make statements that, one, the party was not a wild affair, but simply a very tame convention, and two, that Patsy had been drinking all night. And there were plenty of girls who agreed to make these false statements.
Fuck.
I do wonder how much they got paid.
I do, too.
It's not reported anywhere, but I bet it was a nice chunk of change.
I mean, there had to be more people sexually assaulted at this party.
Absolutely. But who's going to come forward?
Fuck.
They didn't.
They're just being paid off and paid to lie. And I'm sure they're scared.
Yeah,
like...
absolutely. 19-year-old Virginia Lee told reporters the event had been, quote, a jolly affair with lots of good, clean fun.
Good, clean fun.
Grace Downs, who didn't even know Patsy, neither did Virginia Lee, none of these women knew Patsy. Grace Downs said Patsy was, quote, an unrefined lush who had been drinking scotch from a bottle all night. Shame on you, Grace Downs.
That's how I would describe myself in my 20s. But no, that's wrong.
Yeah. And then there was Sugar Guys.
How do you spell guys? G-U-I-S-E?
G-E-I-S-E? I think it's guys. Or geese.
I think guys is right. Sugar Guys.
Sugar Guys. Her mother was a good friend of District Attorney Buron Fitz. And she stated that she had seen Patsy prior to that event passed out at the bar inside the Knickerbocker Hotel. All of these girls lied.
What the fuck?
Patsy's celebrity friends, Bing Crosby, William Frawley, Dick Powell, none of them came forward to vouch for her. In fact, they abandoned her, cut off all contact, because they didn't want their name associated with hers for fear it would ruin their precious careers. Buron Fitz thought he had a foolproof way of ending the case once and for all. With all the men that had been present at the party, there was no way Patsy would be able to identify her rapist. They were all dressed in suits. They're all dressed, you know, similar. And she certainly didn't know any of their names. So he presented her with a pile of a couple dozen photographs of salesmen that had been in attendance. And as she shuffled through them, she came across David Ross's picture and without hesitation said, "That's the man." Mm-hmm. And Fitz was like, are you sure? And she said, "I can never forget that face."
Yeah. Unless Frog Eyes.
Frog Eyes. So he was like, "Well, shit, now I guess we got to convene a grand jury."
Whoa.
He contacted David Ross in Chicago, who said the charges against him were absurd. But Ross flew to L.A., where he was immediately met by Mendel Silberberg, Louis B. Mayer's personal attorney.
Bah.
The grand jury hearing was held on June 16, 1937, where Patsy had to recount the details of her rape to a room full of people. And after she did so, Lester Roth, one of David Ross's attorneys, pointed at her, looked at the jury, and said, "Look at her. Who would want her?"
You better shut your fucking mouth, bitch.
These men are hideous. They are the lowest of the low.
Was the jury all male?
I tried to find out and I couldn't find that anywhere, so I'm not sure. I don't know. Oh my, did you hear my stomach growl?
Did.
That was very loud.
I think it was. It's mad too.
It is.
At this situation.
It was like, rawr, frog eyes.
Give me some frog legs.
How do these people sleep at night?
Probably drinking themselves to sleep.
Probably. And they're all dead now, so.
Right.
How did they sleep at night?
Bye, bitch.
Out of the 120 or so dancers from that party, only two were willing to testify on Patsy's behalf.
Oh, well, that's something.
And one of them was Ginger Wyatt. She was the girl who had run to actor Wallace Beery the night of the party asking for help.
Yeah.
But Wallace changed his story.
God damn it, Wallace.
Originally, he had said he was appalled at how men were acting that night. He'd punched out two guys who were trying to get rough with Ginger, and he escorted her back to base camp to make sure she got home safely. But now, he denied ever escorting Ginger out of the party. He denied punching any of the men, and he said, quote, "The party was very orderly as far as I could see." It's almost like his employer, the world's largest and most powerful film studio, had threatened his career if he didn't say what they wanted him to say. Vincent Conniff, the casting director, said he made it very clear to the girls that the job was for a party. Several dancers, likely paid off by MGM, backed him up. Patsy said, quote, "They never mentioned it was for a party, ever. I wouldn't have gone. Oh, God, I wouldn't have gone." Two men who had been waiters for the party gave sworn affidavits and were questioned about them on the stand. Oscar Budden said, "I have been a waiter for 26 years, and within that time, I have served at hundreds of parties. I have yet to recall a party that the conduct of the men was as unbecoming, the language used by the men was such that you would hear wherever filth is used in conversation." The other waiter, Henry Schultz, said, quote, "The men were very, very hoggish and kind of second class. The men tried to force liquor on the girls. The men's attitude toward the girls was very rough. They were running their hands over the girls' bodies. Anything could have happened on the grounds without anyone knowing about it," because the party was so noisy. To my estimation, the party held at the ranch was the worst, the wildest, and the rottenest I've ever seen.
Thank God somebody spoke out. Jesus, thank you, Lord.
Both of these waiters testified that before the party kicked into gear, the girls were really confused and kept asking questions like, where are the cameras? And when will we start shooting the scene? That just shows you, like, all these girls saying, oh, no, we knew it was for a party. Lies. All lies. The court took a recess, and when Patsy went out into the hallway, her rapist was standing there smoking a cigarette. The bravery she had to have even make her accusations in the first place, let alone have to come face to face with him.
Gross. Yikes.
Photographers, eager to get that money shot, pushed Patsy and David Ross together and told her to look at him.
No.
And shouted at her, look at Mr. Ross. She understandably burst into tears and cried, I can't. I just can't. She then ran down the hallway toward a window. Years later, she tells David Stinn, quote, I was going to jump through the glass to get away from everything and everybody so I couldn't be hurt anymore.
Yeah.
When everyone reconvened back in the courtroom, Ross's attorney called Clement Soth. He was the parking attendant who heard Patsy's screams that night and had seen David Ross run from the scene. But why would Ross's attorney be calling him to the stand?
Oh, no. No.
Under oath, Soth stated the man he saw could not have possibly been David Ross because he was too thin. And the grand jury was like, oh, well, it's not him. He's not skinny. And they did not indict Ross. When that was announced, Ross breathed a sigh of relief. I'm sure he did. He whistled and said, boy, that really makes me happy. I'm going to stay away from Hollywood. Stay away from everyone, David Ross. No one wants you around. And the thing is, given how violent the rape was, him threatening to kill her if she made a sound, there is no doubt in my mind that this was not the first time he raped someone.
Oh, yeah.
Prior to Clement's testimony, MGM had gone to him and were like, are you sure you saw David Ross? Are you absolutely sure? Because if you didn't see David Ross, then we are willing to offer you any job you want. And Clement told MGM, you know what? As a matter of fact, the man I saw was too thin. Yep, he was too thin, couldn't have been Ross. And also, I would like to become a driver for the studio, please and thanks. And MGM said, done, job is yours. Clement Soth worked as a driver for MGM Studios for the rest of his life. And that is a good job. That's a Teamster's job. And it was definitely a huge step up from a parking attendant. Despite this setback, Patsy was persistent. A month after the grand jury hearing, she filed a lawsuit in the Los Angeles County Superior Court against David Ross, Eddie Mannix, Hal Roach, Vincent Conniff, and John Doe 1-50 for their unlawful conspiracy to defile, debauch, and seduce for the immoral and sensual gratification of male guests. This really got MGM freaking out. Patsy was seeking $500,000 in damages. In internal memos that circulated around the studio, they referred to Patsy as their girlfriend. Oh, our girlfriend was in the paper again. Our girlfriend is causing trouble again. She is an underage rape victim. These people are sick. They started paying off anyone and everyone who had witnessed the kind of behavior that had gone on at the party. MGM's lawyers kept delaying the proceedings, and David Ross was never even contacted. In February of 1938, a Superior Court judge dismissed the case. But Patsy was determined.
Jesus Christ, she's so determined.
She
to get them.
And
good for her.
She's the only one standing up for her.
She's the only person who's like, no, this happened and someone needs to pay for it.
Yep.
Fuck.
She refused to let these men get away with this. She filed a lawsuit in the United States District Court. And according to David Stinn's article, this was the first time a female plaintiff made rape a federal case based on its violation of her civil rights.
Wow, shit.
MGM was panicked.
Good.
And then they got incredibly lucky.
No.
Much to Patsy's misfortune. Her attorney, William Brown, was outraged at how District Attorney Buron Fitz had handled this case. And he publicly announced that he would run against Fitz in the next election. And as powerful as MGM was, it was impossible for anyone involved in a lawsuit against the studio to win that election. So when both sides were scheduled to appear in court for the hearing, Brown didn't show up.
Fuck him.
And oddly, neither did the defendant's attorneys. The federal judge rescheduled the hearing, and once again, Brown didn't show. And neither did the other side's counsel. A third hearing date was scheduled. Still, the attorneys didn't show. Almost as if Brown had told MGM of his plan so that their lawyers would also fail to show and the case would get thrown out, clearing the way for Brown to run for district attorney. It was almost like that happened. That's what happened. I can't even imagine Patsy, with everything that she's already gone through up to that point, to be sitting in a courtroom and your attorney, who's been your cheerleader through all of this, who you think has your best interest in mind, just ghosts you. After Brown failed to appear in court three times, the federal judge dismissed the case.
God fucking damn it.
And it was all for nothing because Fitz beat Brown in the election by a landslide. Rumor has it that Mildred, Patsy's mom, was paid off when the case was about to go to federal court so that she wouldn't seek to get Patsy a new lawyer and the case could die. David Ross got off scot-free, though he did later die from rectal cancer, so there's that. Mildred married an alcoholic gambler who spent all her money and left her. Louis B. Mayer died from leukemia. Buron Fitz died by suicide. And before Eddie Mannix's death in 1963, he was asked, "Whatever became of that girlie who took on MGM?" And he jokingly replied, "We had her killed." And metaphorically, they did, because Patsy became reclusive after her case was dismissed. She left LA and moved to Bakersfield, then eventually to Las Vegas. She married three times in 5 years, and they weren't good guys. She had a daughter, but wasn't close with her. She described herself as worthless, naive, stupid, and a lousy mother. It wasn't until 2003, when writer David Stinn contacted her, that she spoke of what happened back in 1937. Mm-hmm. He'd been researching the case for a decade, and I have to say, if it wasn't for him, I don't know that her story would have ever been told. Okay. And it certainly wouldn't have been told by her.
Yeah.
She had never even told her family.
Oh my God.
At first, she was angry that Stinn was contacting her because she didn't want to talk about it, understandably. And she would hang up on him whenever he called. During one phone call, she said, "What was it that I accomplished? What's so special about my story?" And he began telling her about everything he'd uncovered in the past decade. He'd found surviving girls from that party that night who corroborated what Patsy had said. Mm-hmm. He told her the children of Clement Soth had given an apology for the lie their father had told. And that's when Patsy began to open up and agreed to an interview by Stinn. Mm-hmm. The Vanity Fair article is great. I'll link it.
Yeah.
He also made a documentary called Girl 27 using footage of their interview. Patsy was number 27 on the call sheet that night, which is why it's called Girl 27.
Okay.
It is devastating to hear how she went through life because this is something that ruined her entire existence.
Yeah.
She said, quote, "I wasn't trying to get anything. I just wanted somebody to believe me. I couldn't get him out of my mind because he took my innocence, because I was a virgin, and he left me with horrendous memories of my first time. And believe it or not, it affected the rest of my life physically. I was a frigid woman, and I never changed. I have never been in love, and I have never known what it is to love somebody, because I believe no matter how much I feel towards a man, I don't trust. And I've never had an orgasm. I was frigid." Patsy said she was done dating at age 37 and never had a relationship or sex after that. But at age 86, thanks to David Stinn, Patsy got to tell her story. She told him, quote, "Before you found me, I was getting ready to die. I'd buy less food. I wasn't planning to be around long. Now I don't want to go. Now I have something to live for. And for the first time, I'm proud of myself." Patsy died just a few months after that interview. As I said in the beginning, this case had a resurgence when the Me Too movement was in the headlines. Jessica Chastain and Rose McGowan both tweeted about Patricia Douglas and the film Girl 27, calling it required viewing. It's not streaming anywhere right now.
Damn.
It came out in 2007, but you can find clips online.
Mm-hmm.
The documentary didn't get great reviews, but the Vanity Fair article is really thorough, and I'll link it so you can read it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the story of the girl who stood up to the most powerful studio in the world.
That's fucking devastating.
It's horrific. It's awful.
Kate. She was so strong.
And she was. Tried,
she gave it everything.
Everything she
and
had.
These shit stains.
Yep. And they went on and made more money and lived their lives. And
I hope they had very painful deaths.
It sounds like a lot of them did.
Good.
So much about it is sad. But the fact that even decades later, she didn't think that she had accomplished anything.
I mean, they defeated her. And then finally, when she gets to tell her story in a different time,
mm-hmm.
It's almost too late for her.
But one thing she did accomplish, they never had those parties again. And that was something she said back then.
Okay,
she was like, I just want to make sure they don't have these parties anymore. And they didn't.
And they didn't.
That
okay,
was the end so that of that.
Came, so she probably saved dozens, if not hundreds of women from assault.
And she made it so that MGM Studios and other studios had to think a little bit harder about how women were treated, whether they did anything about it or not. They didn't want to have to go through this again.
Well, yeah, because she also was setting a precedent, right?
Exactly.
She's like, there are going to be people who are not going to be quiet about this.
Mm-hmm. So even though it took literally decades to make any real strides in the film industry when it comes to sexual assault in the business, she was the first to say, you can't do that.
You can't fucking do that. Good for her.
Yep.
Good for her. It's still an issue, but I mean, like, it's...
Yeah. She was a pioneer.
Yeah. Good for you, Patsy.
And let us know your thoughts. If you'd heard about this woman, if you've seen the documentary, or just, you know, what you think about this, and leave it in the comments. I think I might, at some point, release this on the main feed. Because
I was going to say, Kate, this is a great story. I think it should be heard by more people.
I think eventually I will, because, yeah, I want more people to know about her. Even when David Stinn was researching for it, he Googled her and nothing came up.
Wow.
And, I mean, now stuff does, obviously,
yeah.
But... I mean, that's why it took him a decade to learn about this, because MGM had it so buried. It was so hidden.
Gross.
Yeah. But we don't think you guys are gross. We think
love
you're awesome. And we love you. And thank you for listening. And thank you for supporting the Patreon. And we hope that you're having a lovely spring thus far. And I don't know if this is coming out on April 1st or April 2nd. I don't know when I'm going to be able to get this edited. But you're getting it soon, and I'm sorry I didn't have it out to you sooner because I was sick and I had tissues stuffed up my nostril. Ba-ba-ba!
Ba-ba-da-da!